advice columnist for Dan's papers in the Hamptons and in Palm Beach, and also for my hometown paper in Winnipeg, the Winnipeg Jewish Post and News. I'm also a national speaker, national radio and television expert guest, and I've been hosting the Ask Beauty Show here on the Progressive Radio Network. We are going into year 10. It's absolutely amazing how quickly the time flies by, which is why it is so important, and you hear me saying this every single week, to find ways to live our lives in ways that are really in our best interest. Now, people often ask me, you know, what is your show all about? What goes on the Ask Beauty Show? Well, in one word, the show is about empowerment. The fact of the matter is that we all go through so many ups and downs in our lives, in our relationships, financially and economically and politically. And even though we can't change our history, the real question becomes, what are we willing to actually do to improve the quality of our lives and our relationships? And of course, I have a mantra, and I try very, very hard to incorporate this mantra, not only into my therapy with patients, but into my own life as well. And that mantra is acknowledge, address, and resolve. Be honest with yourself that you are willing to acknowledge there is a problem. I have a problem with depression, anxiety, or other psychiatric issues, or there are problems in my relationship, or there are financial issues or physical problems, or perhaps you're struggling with substance abuse of various different kinds. So that is the honest acknowledgement. And you're probably not surprised to hear that most people, it takes a very, very, very long time for people to be willing to really be honest with themselves. Say, look, I have some issues here, and I've been trying, or maybe not trying hard enough, for weeks, months, and even years, and I seem to be going around in circles. But I am willing today, and this is what my late father, Morris Sayre, used to tell me every single day. He'd say, Beauty honey, today is a new day with new possibilities. So again, acknowledging the issues and being willing and being really, really self-disciplined to take the necessary steps to really get to where you want to go, which means, of course, improving your life and improving your relationships. And over all these years, it's one thing I hope that I have been successful. I hope I've been successful in a lot of ways in doing the show and making, and maybe perhaps saying some things that are making your life a little bit better and a little bit easier. But what I do hope is that I have convinced you that we do not need to navigate all of this, all of the life stressors on our own. And if you really feel that you are going around in circles, the relationships aren't working, the depression is not going away, you've tried meditation and you've tried a variety of different psychological modalities, but that you're still feeling down in the dumps, or your marriage or relationship is still not improving, or you've been trying to stop drinking or using and yet you haven't been able to be successful. The very, very, very best thing that we can all do is to reach out and ask for help. And I always use the sports and the celebrity genre as an example. You look at the athletes, and of course you've heard me tell you many times that I was number 10 in Canada as a junior, and in those days we didn't have teams. My dad happened to be my coach, but there weren't physiotherapists and sports psychologists and a variety of different people who are really there to help the players become the very best that they can be. So if you're looking at teams and you're looking at team sports, you can see that none of us really get very far on our own. So again, it's about finding a good therapist. And as you've heard me say, all therapists are not the same. There can be harmful experiences that go on in psychotherapy as well. So this is where if you are contemplating reaching out and getting some help for yourself, it's really, really important to get a referral from someone that you trust. So my questions to you every week in my How Are You Doing segments really are the same. And people will say, well, why do you ask the same questions every single week? Well, because these are fundamental questions that we all need to answer if we are hoping and planning and dreaming and having a basically happy and healthy life. So when it comes to mental health, how are you doing? One of the interesting things, I'm doing some consultation at East Hampton High School in East Hampton, and when the roll call is taken by Jim Stewart, who happens to be the head of the health department at East Hampton High School, he doesn't just call the name, which I think is great. He has encouraged all of the students to respond by telling him what number they are on a scale of 1 to 10. And as I've been sitting in on the classes with Jim Stewart, it's so interesting to see, from day to day, hopefully the kids are doing well and their response is an 8 or a 9, and yet the ones that are not doing well, and they are continuing to not do well, at least we know that there's a problem, and we then know that we need to refer these students to a guidance counselor or to a psychologist or to one of the school social workers. So again, it's important for us to be really honest with ourselves, well, honest with ourselves in all kinds of ways, but certainly with our mental health. And if you really do find that you are going around in circles and you just have not been able to get a handle on the depression or the anxiety or the substance abuse, again, I really, really hope that you will give yourself permission. It is not a weakness, it is a strength, to reach out and ask for help. And then, of course, in the other category of relationships, which are so central, they're so central to our emotional and physical and sexual and psychological and psychiatric well-being. Again, the question is, do you have people in your life who you can really count on, who are really there for you? And that means assessing your significant relationship with a spouse if you happen to be married or with a partner. And that also includes assessing your relationships with your children and your family and your friends. And hopefully things are going well. Although, as I mentioned, there are always going to be ups and downs, even in the best of circumstances. But if you're finding that one or more, or even all of your relationships are bringing you down, and that they are highly, highly upsetting and depressing and problematic, again, the question that you need to ask yourself is, what are you actually going to do about it? Because we can complain and we can whine and we can moan, and yet it is so vital that we are willing and prepared to take some action so that we are not living a life where we're basically fooling ourselves about the reality of what is and what is not going on. Another area, substance abuse. Are you drinking too much or using too many drugs? And that includes prescription and over-the-counter medication. And again, if things are getting out of control little by little, the question again is, what are you planning to do about it? And maybe a better question would be, not only are you, what are you planning to do about it, but who are you going to reach out to who can help you to get a handle and normalize things a bit? And what about your physical health? You know, for 2 years during the pandemic, we were inside and wearing masks, and people tended to eat too much and drink too much. But, you know, those days hopefully are behind us. So the real question is, are you doing a good job in taking care of your physical health, including having a complete physical once a year? Including blood work, and do you follow your doctor's advice to take your medications as prescribed? And of course, my big question to everyone is, do you have an exercise protocol, which means walking at least 30 minutes every single day and eating a healthy diet, well-balanced diet, I might add. And I'll tell you what happened to me this morning. I woke up and I knew that I needed to prepare for the show, and I had a couple of other things to do, some articles to finish off, and I was feeling a bit uptight. My husband was out at an appointment, and probably I should have walked cha-cha, but I was just feeling uptight, and I was asking myself, you know, what should I do? Should I continue reading the New York Times? Should I go into my office and prepare a little bit more for the show? And it was clear that that was not going to do the trick for me. So I pondered a number of little options about what really to do. Well, even though I did not feel like it, I went into a room and I lifted my weights for actually probably 15 to 20 minutes. I was still feeling like, no, I'm not quite there. I'm not quite feeling on my game. What to do? What to do? Should I go for a walk? Well, we happened to be very, very fortunate that a good friend of ours gave us, yes, he gave us a treadmill. So again, even though I was not in the mood at all of getting on our treadmill for almost 20 minutes, I ran on the treadmill. Now, did all of my little worries and angst disappear? No, not completely, but I certainly felt better doing what I have to tell you. I initially did not want to do, because I know that for me, exercise is something that is very, very important, as it is for millions and millions of people around the world. It acts as a great antidepressant, a great anti-anxiety. So after doing my little workout, I started to feel a lot better, more on my game, so to speak. But had I just waited to feel as if I wanted to exercise and do the weights and go on the treadmill, I wouldn't have done it, because I didn't feel like doing it. And yet, asking ourselves the question, the same question every single day, actually multiple times as we go throughout our day, is this good for me? What is actually in my best interest? So cognitively, sometimes we just have to go with our intelligent answer, our rational answer, rather than wait for the feelings to surface. And another category, really important, is sleep. How are your sleeping patterns these days? There's been a change of time. Do you have difficulty falling or staying asleep? Or are you getting at least 7 to 8 hours of restful sleep most nights? And that means really getting into a pattern where you're not looking at games and doing puzzles throughout the night, where there needs to be, again, some structure, some self-discipline and structure that you are willing to really live within and follow. Because I have many patients where they are up during the middle of the night, or days or nights, and nights or days, and all of this, it's all going to affect how we feel emotionally and psychologically, and of course, physically. So basically, when it comes under the category of self-care, How would you rate yourself pretending that you were a student at East Hampton High School in Mr. Stewart's class? What would the number be? What would the number be today? Now, hopefully, you're an 8 or a 9 or a 10. But if you're finding that you're a 1 or a 2 or a 3, and of course, we all have days where we're just not feeling all that great. But if those low numbers tend to be a pattern in your life, again, I am tossing the ball into your court. This is the tennis player, using this kind of an analogy, and I'm asking you, what are you going to do? And that is really the question, because it's very, very, very difficult at times to be truthful with ourselves. Yet, what are the consequences if we continue to lie to ourselves? It is the avoidance and the denial and the blame and the self-blame and the defensiveness that really keeps us in a downward spiral. And yes, it takes a lot of courage to be willing to acknowledge, address, and resolve as best as we can, even though we can't change our history, right? The things that continue to get in the way of our lives and relationships. And yet, if we refuse to step up to the plate and confront our demons, our skeletons in the closet, our unfinished business, old and new, as you well know, it becomes increasingly more difficult to fully enjoy our lives. And ultimately, look, there is a choice that we all have to make. Not an easy choice sometimes, especially if you're alone and you don't have a lot of support. But again, every day is a new day where there are possibilities, as there are some little thing that you can do, some little thing that you can embrace that can help you move along to a more constructive path. And I'm really hoping every single week that my intro is motivational and inspirational, and that you will actually take some action to do some things that maybe you didn't do yesterday, maybe you didn't do last year for the last 25 years, but that you are willing to do today to improve the quality of your life and your relationships. And that also includes calling me here on the Ask Dee Dee Show, because initially, we had thought that this was going to be a call-in counseling show because I had hosted many, many call-in counseling radio talk shows on mainstream radio before joining the Progressive Radio Network family. So again, even though it hasn't turned into this kind of an ongoing show, I really invite you. You can email me, you can chat with me. And you can call. The number is 888-874-4888. So don't be shy. When it comes to relationships and it comes to love, things just don't happen on their own. And just like the plants out there, we need to continue to tend, and we need to continue to water the plants so that they are going to grow and blossom. So if you are lucky enough, fortunate enough to be in a great relationship, make sure that you really try to keep the couple at the top of the list of priorities, and not just on special occasions like Valentine's Day or birthdays or anniversaries. You got to really treasure your relationship. It's precious. It requires attention. And don't take each other for granted, because it's the little things that really do make all the differences in the world, and they don't need to cost a lot of money, if any money at all. A surprise card or a flower or a text, just thinking about you. I love you. I mean, it really does wonders. And of course, you've heard me say this for years about the importance of keeping the romance and sex alive. And it definitely is challenging. But remember to make dates and remember to keep them. And when issues arise in your relationship, try to deal with them as soon as possible. Do not let your laundry list of complaints get out of hand. And when you're dealing with problems respectfully and with love, this is what I suggest. And sometimes I am guilty of not doing this. But if you want to do this constructively and respectfully and lovingly, you want to set a time and a place and not when you're going to be going to sleep or running out the door to address the problem so that you will end up with a win-win resolution. Remember, my friends, it is not about always being right. In any healthy relationship of any kind, it's about being willing to make compromises and trade-offs. And that is what happy and healthy couples do. So that is also a very, very important weekly reminder. Weeks ago, I received this email from a reporter. Her name is Maggie Aim, and she happens to be a nurse. And she sent me an email, and she was wanting my feelings and thoughts on sexual bereavement. And it was like, whoa, what is sexual bereavement? Well, she defined it as, if you've had a loss, if your spouse has died, if there's been a divorce, or if there's been a breakup, there are going to be consequences, of course, emotionally and psychologically and financially, and also sexually. And she was wondering, what I thought about how to rediscover, and perhaps for some, discover sexual pleasure after a loss. So this is what I said, and I'd be curious to get some feedback from you. In grieving the loss of a loved one, sex can easily take a back seat, of course, and understandably so. But eventually, the desire for intimacy, and not just emotional intimacy, but sexual intimacy, will probably resurface. And there is no one-size-fits-all solution when it comes to dealing with sexual bereavement, again, so sexual bereavement after the loss of a relationship. The question being, then what happens to your sex drive? What happens to your sexual desire? Sometimes it can feel like experiencing pleasure. And this is something that I had thought about and thought, well, a lot of people who lost their spouses through death, and through divorce may feel, particularly, if they've lost their partners or spouses as a result of death, they may feel that enjoying sex or wanting to enjoy sex with somebody else is somehow disrespectful or a taboo. So what I said, of course, was you need to give yourself permission and time to adjust to many, many different stressors. There's so many different stressors that happen as a result of the death of your partner, or let's add divorce as well, or the end of a significant long-term relationship. I felt, and I do feel, that it's very important to communicate your feelings and concerns with potential partners, because if you're going to be hooking up and having sex, getting into another relationship too soon, it's probably not going to work too well for you or for your partner. So going from a long-term relationship to a brand new one, it's going to take some getting used to, because it's not like you're going to turn on a light switch and you're sexually in tune. Hopefully, however, you have chosen a partner who is empathic, supportive, and understanding. Well, of course, that holds true whether or not we're talking about sexual bereavement or being in any kind of a relationship. We need to be sure, we really do need to be sure that we choose well and that we choose a partner who is empathic, supportive, respectful, and understanding. On the other hand, and I've certainly seen this in my practice, some people may choose not to have sex after their partner dies. And it's important, it's very, very important for us not to judge them or assume that they have some kind of a sexual dysfunction or that something is wrong with them. Because if someone is interested in sex with themselves or partners, and if they can't seem to understand what is getting in the way, so they're interested, they like to engage, they would like to feel sexual and sexy and have desire, but they can't understand what is getting in the way of their interest or desire, that is the time. And not after 2 weeks or 1 month or 2 months. I mean, after the death of a relationship, whether it is through death in the way we think of death or death after a divorce. I mean, people who were divorced certainly do talk about the death of their marriage, their death of their relationship. So again, if you're finding that months and even perhaps years are going by and you would like to be interested in sex, you would like to feel sexy, that is the time to reach out and ask for help and figure out what is going on and not going on and, more importantly, what to do about it. Remember, of course, that issues including hormone imbalances, the sexual side effects of a variety of medication and over-the-counter medications, and possible mental health issues, and of course, relationships, can all affect our sexual desire or lack of. And recently, I have been reading some articles written by world-renowned sex therapist Esther Perel and other people who have been talking about desire and how to keep the sizzle in your sex lives. And one of the things that I feel has been remiss in all of the analysis and all the explanations about why we lose desire in our relationships are exactly some of the things that I've just mentioned. For example, depression, anxiety, low self-esteem, eating disorders, sexual abuse, sexual assault, domestic violence, all of these things are going to affect our sexual desire and sexual interest. There's just no question about it. So it's much, much more than only talking about making sure that we find ways to keep the sizzle in our lives and in our sex lives. I mean, other things too. If we're not feeling connected to our partners, and if we're not feeling that there is a satisfying emotional as well as sexual connection, particularly for women, this is going to be the last thing in the world that people are going to want to do is connect sexually with someone who they are so angry with, that they're so disappointed with, that they don't respect. So again, in looking at sexual issues, in looking at issues like depression or anxiety, it is so vital. It is so vital that we get to the root of the problem. Other things that are almost never mentioned in any of these articles are the sexual side effects of prescription and over-the-counter medication, including high blood pressure medication, cholesterol medication, alcohol, and drugs. I mean, all of these things can and do interfere with our sexual desire and sexual interest. To be talking about how to help couples keep and put the sizzle in their sex lives and in their relationships without talking about all of these things, I think is medical malpractice. And somebody would say, gee, aren't you kind of overstating this? And no, I'm not. I think that if we're going to be treating people, if we're going to be giving people explanations and answers to their particular problems, we need to look at things in a very holistic, in a very systemic kind of way, rather than just pretending that putting a bandage on a problem is going to solve the problem and do the trick. So again, if you are someone who is struggling with your sex life, you know, these are the things that you need to look at, you know, your own emotional health, well-being, your relationship, the sexual side effects of drugs and alcohol and hormones. And if you're seeing a doctor, I mean, these are the kinds of issues that actually need to be discussed. They need to be acknowledged and addressed and resolved. And let's not forget that we're not just talking about middle and upper middle class people. Issues like poverty, unemployment. I mean, every single day in the business section, you are seeing companies letting go of more and more and more employees. Today in the business section, I noticed that NPR, you know, the radio station, they are letting go 10% of all of their employees. And I think it was last week, Amazon let go, it was either 5,000 or 50,000. So things like poverty, unemployment, physical illness, racism, homophobia, all of these things affect our emotional well-being, our physical well-being, and our sexual well-being as well. So again, if you are someone who is reaching out for help, I probably would advise you to do some of your own homework and to make sure that when you are seeing somebody for the first time, that at least you have a handle on some of the issues that may not be brought up in an initial conversation that actually do need to be looked into and do need to be discussed. Now, moving along, New York Times, the big opinion piece today had to do with the television show Succession, which I absolutely love. I don't know how many of you watch Succession on HBO. So the headline in this opinion piece is on Succession, the Logan family business is trauma. So I'm going to quote you a couple of paragraphs from this opinion piece that was written by Emily St. James. Most discussions around HBO's enormously successful series Succession focuses on the show's depiction of the ultra wealthy and the media, and with good reason. The absurdly rich Roy family, and that's the family at the drama center, controls a huge media empire, and its members squabble for control. But those discussing allayed the show's nuanced discussion of intergenerational trauma and families built atop a legacy of abuse. And I really, really, really would suggest that you tune in. It actually is going to be beginning again, the new series. I believe it's going to be this coming Sunday. So again, the intergenerational trauma and families built atop a legacy of abuse is really what this show is all about. And when those with money and power lose themselves in a trauma spiral, it's often everyone else on the planet who gets damaged. They go on to say, Succession, like a lot of art being made right now, explores trauma and its perpetuation. Trauma is a reaction of the brain to something so painful or stressful that it disrupts our narrative of the world around us, which is why children of abusive parents are so often riddled with it. We see it go on from one generation to another. Often trauma survivors will do anything that they can do to attain security and safety. Yet their ideas, and this is something so important, of what security looks like can become deeply warped. In the case of the Roy's children, who have suffered their father's abuse their whole lives, that security, in quotes, has taken the form of endless amounts of money and power that might seal them off from anything objectionable. They live in a luxurious snow globe world where they have all the very finest things, yet the money that affords them such a heightened lifestyle has also sealed them inside the snow globe with a father who terrorizes them. Well, this is the situation, you know, and I don't know how many people that you know who are growing up in abusive situations and where the generational patterns of abuse continue from one generation to another. And as I was reading the article, I thought I really, really need to write something, a letter to the editor, which I have done previously, because I felt very, very strongly that we have this idea, because people may be rich and they may have a lot of power, that somehow, that they may be immune from the devastation, from the actual devastation that occurs from being and remaining in an abusive relationship. So this is what I wrote. It took me about 25 minutes to do, and I'm very, very curious about what you think, because this is a reminder. This is a reminder to all of us and for people who have been and who continue to remain in abusive relationships. And it's just five lines. Love is not abuse. And this is what I wrote. And I hope that is going to be printed in the letters to the editor section of the New York Times next week. Sooner or later, and please, please take this in, sooner or later, despite one's socioeconomic background, ethnicity, religion, gender, or sexual orientation, people always, yes, they always pay an enormous price emotionally, psychiatrically, and physically when they allow and enable others to hurt and abuse them. Regardless, and this I think is the key, regardless of the perceived but misconstrued secondary gain. So what does this mean? So somebody might say, well, you know what? He or she has a lot of money. We live an amazing lifestyle. And I had a patient several years ago who I was treating when I lived in Sarasota, Florida. And she came in, and the very, very first visit, she says, I want you to know, if you ask me to leave my husband, I am going to walk out of your office. Of course, I didn't really know why she would say that and what she was talking about. But this is what she told me. She told me, look, we have a luxurious lifestyle. We have a house on the water. We have homes around the world. We have a private plane. And yes, he is abusive to me once or twice a year. And it was like once or twice a year. I mean, that's pretty terrible. And when I started to ask her about her family history and how she grew up and what it was like as a child for her, she told me that she had been physically abused every single day of her entire life as a child. So in her mind, the fact that she had all of this luxury and power and all of these material goods, and that he only hit her once or twice a year, in her mind, and of course it was in quotes an improvement after having been hurt and beaten every single day. So what was interesting and worked out really well is that she was actually willing to explore her childhood, and she was willing to actually learn what the ingredients were that went into a healthy relationship. And finally, she was able to see that, yes, even though he only, in quotes, hit her once or twice a year, that she was no longer going to permit this. So what happened was is that we invited her husband to join us. We're sitting in my office, and she started the conversation, and she said, "Look, I love you very much, and I love our lifestyle, and I love what you've been able to provide for us. But what I've learned about myself and what I've learned about our marriage is that I will never, ever, ever allow you to hurt me or to hit me again." And I remember he sat there just so flabbergasted. This was a man who was a pillar of society, not only in Sarasota, but around the world. And he was used to people just yesing him and not questioning him. And they had been married for over 25 years. So for 25 years, there was a pattern of behavior that she enabled because she hadn't up to this point been able to work through. Yes, even though it was only twice a year, that it should have been zero times, and that abuse of any kind was never, ever, ever again going to be tolerated. So the question then becomes, if you happen, and I hope you're not, but if you happen to be in an abusive relationship, and I'm talking about verbal, physical, sexual, emotional, financial, okay? The question that I want you to ask yourself is this: what role are you playing that helps to keep the dysfunction and the abuse going? Now, I'm not directing this question to children, because that is a whole other thing where kids are absolutely powerless, which is why at East Hampton High School, and I'm so proud to be a part of the team where we are teaching the kids early on about healthy relationships, dysfunctional relationships, abusive relationships. So hopefully if they are experiencing any or all of the above, that they will be able to know and to give themselves permission to reach out to some of the really wonderful school personnel at East Hampton High School. So again, the question then becomes, what role are you playing that helps to keep the dysfunction or the toxicity or the abuse going? Because in every relationship, now think about this, people dance and dance. At times we are in step with each other. And at other times, it is the missteps, the abuse, the violence, the disrespect that seems to define our relationships. So what do we do, again, not just think, but what do we do when we discover that the dance is no longer fun and, in fact, has become unbearable or even dangerous? We do have choices, although it may seem that we don't. So what are the choices? We can do nothing. And we can just play out the role of victim for the rest of our life. And believe it or not, there are many, many people who do choose that option. They don't have the support, and they've given up. Or we can complain. We can complain for months and weeks and years that it's a terrible relationship, and we can just continue To complain. Option number two, we can withdraw, you know, passive aggressive. We're just not going to engage. Option number four, we can threaten to leave. I'm going to leave. I'm going to leave. If you don't do this, if you don't do that, I am going to leave, but we don't leave. Option number five, we can accept the role of doormat. And I have seen this in countless, countless situations with couples over the past 35 plus years that I have been treating, really thousands of people who have been involved and engaged in domestic violence relationships and abusive relationships of various different kinds. And when they arrive at my doorstep, that's basically what's happened. They were able to do nothing for years. They complained for years. They withdrew for years. They threatened to leave for years. But then they got to a point where they no longer wanted to accept the situation. Option number six. We can hope and dream. Yes, we can hope and dream and fantasize that things are going to get better on their own. Or option number seven. And I didn't realize that, but lucky number seven. Option number seven. Or we can make a decision that we no longer will enable or accept the status quo and begin to make preparations to exit the toxicity, because you've tried every possible thing to get your partner to step up and it has not happened. So you've done nothing. You complained. You withdrew. You threatened to leave. You accepted the role of doormat. You hoped and dreamed. Nothing changed. And finally, 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 you had enough. So what is an enabler? An enabler is someone who, for a variety of reasons, feels powerless and has learned and is willing to accept destructive and self-destructive behavior. And typically, they learned all of this growing up in their families, whether this was either a repeat performance of what went on and what did not go on when they were children growing up. And some of these explanations include, you know, fear of abandonment and financial ruin. I mean, ending a relationship is no easy thing, even though it may be a terribly toxic relationship. And the fear of financial ruin. A lot of people, the fear of being alone is so devastating that they would rather be with someone who hurts them and abuses them rather than make the choice of finding ways to live alone. Obviously, poor self-esteem. Again, a family history where these types of behaviors were normalized and accepted. Or a conscious or unconscious false belief that he or she is somehow to blame and is therefore deserving of maltreatment. I mean, so many couples that I've treated over the years, you know, where there was abuse, typically the man would say, well, you made me do it. You made me hit you. You made me so upset that I was not able to control my behavior, blaming the victim rather than taking responsibility for his or her own disgustingly toxic behavior. And these are the kinds of things that need to be worked out in therapy with both women and men who are victims of this kind of abuse. And although some or all of the fears and beliefs may be real, the enabler, you play a very, very important role in keeping the dysfunctional dynamic going. It can't keep going if you stay in. If you do nothing, if you only complain, if you withdraw, if you threaten to leave, if you accept the role of doormat. And yet, having said that, it takes a lot of courage to be able to say to yourself, first of all, and then to your partner, that enough is enough, and be willing to walk away from a toxic situation. And yet, what I've found over the years, and the literature certainly supports this, that many, many people remain in untenable situations because of their own fears and unresolved problems. And the reality, however, is that sooner or later, and it always happens, it just is a question of sooner or later, these toxic relationships have the potential to destroy us emotionally, psychologically, and even physically. So, for those of you who are listening to the show right now, and I hope that you are not in an abusive, toxic relationship, but if you need to, reach out to me in any way, perhaps you don't want to call me during the Ask Beattie show, you can go to my beattiecohn.com website, and you'll be able to find all of the contact information. And this is tough. And recently, I actually received a letter from a woman from West Hampton, because I'm the advice columnist for Dance Papers in the Hamptons. And this is what she writes. I'm a 27-year-old professional woman who's been in a relationship with John for the past 2 years. He has cheated on me, and at times our relationship has become violent. He's had legal problems because of his drug issues, but still refuses to get help. You probably think I'm crazy, but I really love him. We've broken up many times, but always end up getting back together. I recently found out that I'm pregnant and really don't know what to do, and I need some advice. Well, very quickly, dear Amanda, I'm truly sorry for your situation. My question to you is this: why do you think that you have stayed in such an abusive and dysfunctional relationship with someone who has hurt you over and over and over again? And although John clearly has his own problems, I think it's important for you to first figure out why you have agreed to and enabled this destructive, self-destructive, and self-sabotaging relationship for it to go on for 2 years. And that's the real question. So I ask you, did you happen to come from an abusive family where you may have learned that abuse was a normal part of a relationship? Where did you learn that your need for love and security are not important? You say that you love him. However, it sounds like there is little, if anything, loving about your relationship. Love is not abuse. Love is about respect, commitment, consideration, sharing, caring, patience, empathy, trust, and a willingness to work out problems. And it sounds like there is none of this in her relationship with John. And then I add, since you're about to become parents, it would be a perfect time to get some much needed professional help, both individually and as a couple. And if he refuses to go, you need to go by yourself. And the big question, she's pregnant. She's going to be bringing a child into this world. Do you really want to bring an innocent child into the toxicity that you describe? And then I end the letter by saying, please let me know if I can help you learn about what real love is and how to learn to take better care of Amanda. And if not now, like in the Hebrew scriptures, if not now, when? Now, I have not yet heard back from Amanda. And hopefully, she's in West Hampton, not a far drive from East Hampton. Hopefully, she is going to take some steps to take care of herself and of her, her unborn child, who is going to be arriving within the next few months. So, everybody. Excuse me. It is 3:54, and where has the time gone? I have piles of other articles and issues that I really wanted to talk with you about today. And as I say, I hope that every week that there really is something, some little thing that I say where you can have an aha moment and where it can make a positive difference in your life. And I still, even though this has not turned into a call-in counseling show, I still really encourage you to go to my beatycode.com website. And if you need to reach out to me, you can call me, you can text me, you can email me, and of course, you can always reach me through the Progressive Radio Network station. So, as I do every single week, I want to leave you with my two weekly messages. See, I start the show by asking you, how are you doing? And I end the show with two messages that I hope will really help to empower you and educate you and really keep you safe. So, what is the first message? The first message, of course, is to make sure that you are doing everything possible every single day. Maybe you're not going to do it perfectly, but to be really mindful of living your life in ways that are in your best interest. And as I remind my patients to ask themselves during the course of the day, this one question, is this good for me? Whatever this happens to be. And secondly, we really, given the state of the world today, we all really need to do a much, 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 much better job in learning to love each other, in learning to accept each other, differences and all. So again, I want to thank you all so much for tuning in and listening to the Ask Beatty show every single week. As I say, it's been over 10 years. It's really amazing. You know, when I first came to New York, and I remember sitting down with Dr. Gary Null at the old Progressive Radio Network studio and talking about, you know, my doing the show. And of course, I love doing the show. I love the producers. I love being a part of the Progressive Radio Network. And I love being able to try, and I do my very best to educate and empower all of you and help to keep you safe. So, goodbye, everybody. Have a very, very good rest of the day, and I will talk with you next week. Take care. Love yourself. Love each other. We'll talk next week. Bye-bye.